Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined with my co-host, Dave C. Let's dive in.
On this episode, we have Jamie Ager, who is a co-founder and the CEO of Hickory Nut Gap. Hickory Nut Gap is supporting regenerative agriculture through their family farm and a group of aggregated farms selling both branded and ingredient cuts of beef, pork, and chicken. In this episode, we learn more about Hickory Nut Gap's origin story, Jamie and the Ager family's journey to both revive their family farm and create a successful regional regenerative meat brand. We also dive into topics like certifications, margins, utilization, and the proper way to fund the scaling of a branded regenerative meat company. We discuss what the future holds for both Hickory Nut Gap and the regenerative agriculture movement at large. So let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. We have Jamie Ager from Hickory Nut Gap here with us today. We're pumped to have Jamie. I know we're definitely going to talk about some topics that we're all very passionate about, one being that animals have to be a part of the regen ag equation, but we will cover that and much more. But welcome to the show, Jamie. We're happy to have you.
Thank y'all for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely, man. Well, let's start where it all started. I know you have a lovely wife that was involved, and it's kind of been a whole family ordeal, but give the audience kind of just the background on Hickory Nut Gap and how it all started and the journey to date.
Yeah, man. So I'm a fourth generation farmer here from Western North Carolina. My family's been here since 1916, so over 100 years here at the farm. My great grandparents moved to this place back in 1916, and so we've been here a long time. My great grandparents, my great granddad was a minister. And his wife, my great-grandmother, was an artist. And so they were very idealistic, a good idealistic combination. Yeah. And I always joke that, you know, when they first came to Western North Carolina in 1916, the Western North Carolina was still in the economic doldrums of kind of post-Civil War South. And you know, as idealistic people, some work that they did was they founded a farmers co-op here in this region called the Farmers Federation. And because he was a minister and he had gone to Yale as well, and so he had some like blue blood connections up to the rich people in the city. And by the 1920s, there was some real money getting made in that world. And so he would go up every year, and they would bring like an Appalachian string band up to New York, and they would raise a bunch of money and bring it down here and build like warehousing infrastructure. They would put a bunch of feed and seeds together. Every year they would have a picnic in every county throughout Western North Carolina, and they would kind of have entertainment sessions with some bluegrass music, with some clogging, with some various singing, gospel.
This is
roots.
Like some grassroots guerrilla marketing playbook.
Yes,
I know.
For like early 20th century.
Yeah. So I come from a family with a legacy of like learning how to party and throw parties and build community
and grow food.
And because he was a minister, he kind of was legit in all these communities and could go and preach on Sunday and really gain people's trust. And so it was kind of a neat family legacy that we've always had here. And then, you know, the farm was a pretty typical small farm here in Western North Carolina. We never got the row crop bug too badly because it's too steep. And here in the mountains, it just doesn't really work that well. And so they grew a big victory garden during World War II. So that's always neat to read about. And then after the war, or World War II, I should say, they put in a dairy. So that dairy lasted until I was a little boy. We always had beef cattle. We have chickens. The old chicken house here on the farm, my mom still manages today. It's about 600 laying hens. And it's a 1940s era chicken house that the Federation kind of promoted as as the most modern technological methods. And so, you know, when I went to college, when I was in high school, we'd sold the dairy. The farm wasn't like really going really financially strong, but it was a great place to raise me and my three brothers. And that was probably the primary role that it played, was like putting up hay all summer, you know, feeding cows, doing whatever has to be done, fixing fence. And I loved it. I thought it was so much fun every year. And you know, you're kind of working with your family. And by then it was mostly my mom kind of running the day to day. And so it was kind of very matriarchal culture in that way. And so it was kind of neat. So, you know, here I am, young guy, kind of like my parents were kind of back to the landers as well. They always grew a big garden. We always kind of ate our own meat. So that was part of what I was used to. And so whenever I went to college, I went to Warren Wilson College just up the road and had some inkling about what organics was, sustainability, sustainable ag, all that kind of thing. And the Warren Wilson has a working farm, and they had just brought in a new farm manager who was more oriented towards sustainable ag and everything.
Wow.
And so it was a really good fit.
Real quick, before you get into sustainable ag, you mentioned that you had some like preconceived notions to organics and preconceived ag. Before you started school, what did you think about sustainability in agriculture? And then how did your time in school affect those preconceived notions?
So that's a great question. I guess when I was in high school, I really got like the ability to kind of, you know, do what you have to do on a farm, make hay, drive a tractor, hook up trailers, manage equipment, do all that kind of stuff, right? Build fence.
Yeah.
And so I loved all that stuff. And then, you know, kind of had a notion, I guess, culturally, as my parents kind of had some level of interest in organics and in this particular part of the country was the home of Mother Earth News magazine. And so a lot of the original founders were kind of from here too. So a lot of the people that lived on the farm at that time kind of had worked at Mother Earth News. By the time I was kind of in middle school and high school, Mother Earth News had gotten sold and moved to most of their operations to New York. But so all these people were no longer working there, but they had a very cultural, you know, back to the land or organic feel to everything. And so, and then Warren Wilson definitely had that as a, as an institution. So, you know, more cultural, I would say. I was interested in it, but I didn't really understand it super well. But then when I went to college, it was kind of like, I got into it. And then a girl that I was interested in, which is generally true of young dudes, had interned at Joel Salatin's farm. And she asked me if I wanted to go with her for a weekend to visit a farm. And I was like, sure, let's go.
And could have been anywhere, but it happened to be a farm.
Yeah. And then I got evangelized to all weekend by like the master of evangelizing. Yeah. And that pretty much changed my life. I mean, Joel Salatin definitely changed my life. And that I was, you know, 19 years old and had a farm and wanted to farm. And then he kind of gave me the literature and the sort of practical ability to kind of chart that path. So that's kind of what got me interested in, and I feel lucky because by the time I was kind of a sophomore in college, I kind of found my passion and just kind of went full bore at that point.
The school you're at wasn't ag school?
So it's a liberal arts school, but they do have a working farm, and part of the curriculum at the school is a triad. It's a work service education triad. So there's actually a work component to it. So we all had to work 15 hours a week. It's a great school, and it's got an amazing farm. It's a couple hundred acres, and it's a real resource for young people and a great place to kind of, you know, when you're working hard in school, it's nice to go build fence for a couple hours to kind of blow off steam and use your body for a minute.
Yeah,
when you're in your, you know, that age.
So you graduate and you go immediately back to the farm then.
So an important detail that I left out, probably the most important detail that I left out, is that I found Amy, and
I was waiting for this part.
she was working on the farm as well there at Warren Wilson. Mm. And she was actually kind of picked by the manager to kind of help build their marketing program for their beef program. Cool. To start direct marketing the beef off the farm. Cool. And so we started dating. And then our senior year, we were dating for a couple years. We started our sophomore yeah. year, took a little break, and then got back together our junior year. And then our senior year, we did a independent project around like this farm and kind of put the book, mm-hmm. started getting into the books a little bit, which were mostly like my mom's handwritten notes and, you know, things like that. And we just kind of came back here young, fired up and idealistic about saving the farm and making it all work. And now we're in our 40s and we're still idealistic and fired up about saving farms and making them work. So it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Did you ask Amy out literally on the college farm, like out in the farm? Was that when you asked her for the first day?
So I was pretty shy in college. And I actually, you know, as a big family farm here, I've got lots of cousins. Mm-hmm. And I was roommates yeah. with one of my cousins. And he was a yeah. little more extroverted than I was and a little more handsome. And so he was a great resource because he was... He asked her to go to lunch with us. Wingman. That's right. Total wingman. Total wingman. So it's fun. We had a good time.
Love that. So y'all are back on the farm. And how do we get from then to the Hickory Nut Gap of 2022?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically we graduated, started selling local. We raised, I can't remember, maybe 1,000 chickens that first summer. No, not that many. Maybe 400. And then we did a couple batches of turkeys for Thanksgiving. And then we raised some hogs as well, sold those. We started getting the beef program kind of oriented towards a grass finishing thing. We also traveled a little bit those first couple of mm-hmm. years. Amy and mm-hmm. I worked in Hawaii for a couple of months on a grass-fed nice. Ranching operation. Rick Hobine and his wife had just had a baby, and my brother was in the Navy and was in Guam at the time, so we all traveled there and met up in Hawaii, and then we worked on these ranches and a big produce operation. And you know, the farm here at home was functional in the winter time, just feeding cows and stuff. My mom and dad were totally mm-hmm. able to do that. So Amy came back to the farm with a compromise that we got to travel some in the winters. And the mm-hmm. second year we actually went to New Zealand and worked on some farms over there as well. So we got kind of nice. Exposed to all these grass-based paradigms as part of our travels. I think she still complains, but also participates in the fact that whenever we travel anywhere, we go visit farms and look at agriculture. So that's always been part of the deal. But, you know, we started selling grass-fed beef, pasture-raised pork off the farm, and we had some success. I mean, people were interested. There was enough interest. We were kind of stringing it all together. And then...
Give us a timeline. You know, when did you start selling grass-fed? Because, you know, grass-fed is gaining in popularity still, but I'm curious, you know, how early were you?
2000s when we came home and started doing that.
So that's pretty early.
Pretty early. Yeah, totally. Like, nobody even knew what it was. It was very early. It was very early. And then we started, you know, but we were super lucky in that Asheville was a great market for us.
Yeah.
And we're 20 minutes from downtown. Here at the farm. And so we were able to kind of start to talk to chefs, and the food scene in Asheville was really starting to blossom at that time. So, you know, everything just kind of came together and we started selling more and more product locally. And so by 2003, we were making it work and I, you know, put a bunch of fencing infrastructure on the farm and all the kind of water lines and all that kind of things that you need. And then by 2004, we were like 26 at that time, and we got pregnant with our oldest son, who just turned 18 yesterday, so that's kind of cool.
Hey,
that
crazy.
Was a big deal. But we were doing fine economically, but it was, you know, more of a reality check and like, oh, crap, here we go. Now we got a kid, like life's happening. And and so at that time, we also... We're selling at tailgate markets. We were selling to some chefs, and demand just was pretty strong. and mm-hmm. I could sell. I could go to town and sell. I always joke that I was I was go to these restaurants and you'd be like, hey, do you want to pay twice as much for your ground beef? That was kind of my introductory line, you know. And that was a good way to kick things off. But and then it gives you a chance to explain the product and why it matters and all that. And so from there, I guess in 04, we got to travel to Terra Madre, the slow food gathering in Italy. So I traveled over there. And you know, I think it was interesting. I sat next to Michael Pollan over there during during Prince Charles' speech. And I asked him, because I was hanging out with Joel Salatin, was there as well. And I saw the two of them hanging out. And I had read Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire book just in my sort of general life. And I was like, oh, he's a smart, funny guy. And so I chatted with him the whole time, because it takes forever for these guys to come out and actually make a speech. And he was telling me all about the sort of thesis of the Omnivore's Dilemma. And so then, you know, when that came out in 2006, I feel like that's when the lid really blew off the grass-fed industry and the pasture-based livestock world. That was kind of the first cultural. He had an article in the New York Times Magazine, the Power Steer, I think it was called, where he traced an animal all the way through the supply chain and kind of told that story. And then he contrasted it with Joel Salatin's kind of pasture-based livestock program and really kind of, you know, created a nice dichotomy and a bifurcation of the two models. And so it's just kind of an opportunity that in Asheville grew, and the natural food stores wanted product. By then I also had taken an ag leadership class through NC State and met a bunch of other farmers. And I was kind of the weird organic guy, but also able to, you know, it's still agriculture, right? And at the end of the day, that's kind of where I stand, is like the farmers that make agriculture work are just trying to make a living, be on the farm, do it right. The only option that farmers have had for the past 100 years was basically driven by consumer demand for cheap food. And so whoever went, the only people that were able to win were the ones that could do it the most cheapest, fastest, whatever. And then the opportunity to kind of think about quality, to think about a more holistic model, just didn't really exist. And so as I took this ag leadership class, I met some other farmers. We kind of saw that the market was going to grow beyond what we could produce here at the home farm. And so I met Sam Dobson was really the first one I met. And Sam's just a great guy, a great friend. And he's a dairy farmer in Iredell County here, and had some extra capacity with his grazing programs. And so he just started growing some, he was doing some really nice ryegrass finishing for his dairy cows, stuff like that. And so that just kind of was a good synergistic partnership. And we were harvesting pretty close to the farm over there. So we were able to kind of provide a fresh beef program to a local natural food store at that time. And then from there, we just kept growing. You know, we Earth Fair is a regional chain of natural foods around here. They were interested in product. So we just kind of kept syncing up our supply chain with farming partnerships with the customers.
Jamie, I'm guessing the first thing you went into in retail was in the meat case, so non-branded, right? But when was the first Hickory.gat branded product, and how did that come about?
That's a great question. You know, we didn't think a lot about branding and marketing before we kind of had numerous iterations of our name. We were called Springhouse Meats. That was one of our original names. And then, but our farm is decently well known in this region. We've had people around the farm all over the years. My granddad was a public figure for sure in this region. And so Hickory Nut Gap was a known thing to some degree in our really local community. And so as we sort of started thinking about that, the founder of Earth Fair is a man named Randy Talley, and he's become a really good friend at this point, and as well as a great customer. But Randy came up to me at Farmer's Market one day, this is probably like 05, 06, and he's like, you know, he's kind of a charismatic business guy, and like, Jamie, you know, this is the next thing. This is like natural meat 2.0. Like, you're on it, man. And like, the way you do this is with branding. And he kind of went on and on and gave me some of like the marketing books to read, like Seth Godin and some of these others. And I was like, okay, cool, let's check it out. And we actually found one of our customers was shopping in the store, and they were a graphic designer. And so we were like, hey, do you want to like, can you help us out? And they were like, we'll trade for meat. And so basically they traded for $1,000 worth of meat. And we went through the whole like, and Amy is super artistic and remarkable around her ability for like an eye for things. And so she really led that charge 100% and kind of made all that happen. And so then we kind of got a brand that we still use today. The Hickory Nut Gap brand is what we kind of built from that time. And so I guess your question, Anthony, was, remind me what the question was. Mm-hmm. Again. Oh, branded product.
So first product and customer was what? Like a brick of ground beef and an earth?
No, it was like a big bag of ground beef that was like super disorganized and like,
like how big was
like a 10 pound like sack of ground beef.
Oh my god.
Yeah, awesome. And then the white butcher paper was the way that those old butchers did it. So that was probably the first ones that we did. We sold like quarter cows, like that, and then
so that just with like a Hickory Nut Gap sticker.
No, to hold it no, together, no, kind of just like a handwritten box with like. who was our first customers? Mike Bostick. He's our neighbor up here. He bought a quarter cow, and I was in the back of a truck trying to get it all worked out. Amy was doing the invoicing. I mean, it was a very homespun operation. And but then we started thinking about
that's funny.
When this movement was catching the eye of a lot of these kind of old school USDA like freezer beef family run processing operations. And the one we were using first was over in Greenville, Tennessee, in East Tennessee. Snaps Ferry Packing, and they kind of got a label machine that we could actually like send some PDF files over to get that type of thing on it.
Get all technical.
And so we're like, ooh, this is sophisticated. And he had done some stuff for some of these direct marketers up in Virginia, so we got that all worked out. And then from there, basically, the farmer's market was probably the first time we had branded product, like in a retail pack. And then we really didn't have anything on like any retailer's shelf until Ingles, our local like 200 store chain in this area, which is a great partner and very much a local business to Western North Carolina, but a big company, $4 billion in revenue. Yeah. But they picked us up.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a real company, and they've done a great job kind of building out a grocery chain that's Western North Carolina, North Georgia, East Tennessee, but they don't hit any of the big cities because they don't want to piss off like Publix or Kroger or anybody. And they really built a great company. And, they're very progressive minded, and they saw the opportunity for like pasture-based local grass-fed beef. And they brought us in probably 10 years ago at this point. And that's been a great partnership.
Wow.
Okay, wow. So I mean, we're talking grass-fed beef, grass-finished beef. You know, some pasture-raised hog, and it sounds like pasture-raised turkey and chicken as well. When did the term? And this is like from a consumer standpoint, like regenerative is a new term. When did that term start to pop up on your radar? And what did the transition from grass-fed to regenerative look like? From like a practice perspective, from a marketing perspective, like what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that. When I graduated from college, I graduated with a degree, I did a major in history and environmental studies. I did a double major. And so the environmental studies degree was in concentration in sustainable agriculture, because that was kind of the vocabulary that we used. It was kind of broader than just organics, right? And this was when the organic vendors first came out. And so organic kind of got under some fire because of the rigidity of those standards. And we weren't certified organic here, and most meat wasn't, right? Because of the, we could have a grain fed organic program. So it wasn't a super helpful word to connect to customers with.
Yep.
And we always kind of came at it with a very regenerative approach around rotational grazing, around like mob grazing became a term that we used for a while that got sort of popular. But these concepts of cover cropping, I mean, a lot of them originated with organics, and then organics didn't really know what to do with the livestock sector super well early on. And so they didn't really nail the regenerative part of that production method. And then ultimately, you know, a standards-based approach to a definition that's a consumer word like organic is just agriculture is way too complicated to be described in a single claim, regardless of the claim. And so, you know, our belief in the sort of, you know, Joel Salatin sort of called it the beyond organic belief of like improving everything as opposed to just, you know, meeting a standard is kind of the right mentality. And I totally agree with that. And I think probably the first time I heard the word regenerative was, I would say, like 2014 or 2015. And I did like it. I thought it's a helpful word because it does kind of help understand and explain that we're not just sustaining something and keeping it going. You're actually creating something that's improving all the time. The belief that as humans, we can be stewards of the land in a way that creates a positive impact, and that you can eat food that actually improves things, is a pretty paradigm shifting spiritual thing almost, right? Like there's a connection to that belief that is exciting. And so to me, that was
cool. It's like the difference between do no harm and to do good, you know? It's like not do evil, but to actually do something that's making a positive impact. And I very much as a consumer resonate with that paradigm shift that you just talked about. So really appreciate you calling that out.
Yeah, totally. I mean, honestly, though, like by then, so Sam, Sam's part of the, we've been working with Sam now for 10 years by this time. And, you know, we're all discussing this word that's come around, regenerative. And there's some skepticism, very reasonable skepticism about all the vocabulary around the natural foods industry. You know, no antibiotics, no hormones. The non-GMO claim was kind of hot at that time, too. And, you know, that really didn't have much teeth at all to it, other than just not being a genetically modified product. But it was still full of chemicals. And so the organic industry was taking a hit on this non-GMO claim as kind of brands were using it instead of organic and kind of, you know, getting similar shelf space, getting similar retail prices. And so there was some skepticism within the organic community about that claim. And you know, the regenerative one was like, oh, great, here's the next iteration of it. How are we going to do that? And so, you know, I've always had a little bit of a skeptical notion about just single word claims. But clearly, at this point, regenerative is the word that's rising.
Yeah.
And it's the best word so far that describes it. You know, there is some concern that it's going to get co-opted by various agricultural interests as consumer interest and demand grows for it. And my hope is that we can kind of help lead that charge around the definition of regenerative, and ultimately help to kind of secure it as a production method that really takes a multi-stakeholder engagement belief system around, you know, everybody wins. And the cool thing about a regenerative is that, you know, the key to it is that you need good farmers on the land to help make stuff happen. And that, to me, is exciting to kind of help drive what the definition of regenerative becomes.
Yeah. So let's go there, right? How is Hickory Nut Gap regenerative? I know you guys work with Savory, and I'll let you kind of explain what that whole process is and what you guys believe in that methodology. But maybe also level set with the regen story. What products are you selling? Where can they be found at? What channels are you selling them in, on top of kind of how is Hickory Nut Gap regenerative?
So, you know, regenerative ag is this, you know, improving things all the time belief system. And what we've done here is, you know, one thing we're lucky for is we're in the Southeast, and the Southeast is a great place to grow year-round grass-fed beef. We can finish cattle here in the wintertime. We work with farmers in Eastern North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia to finish cattle through the wintertime, and then we can work with farmers in the Piedmont and the mountains here in the summertime. So we really do have the ability to grow grass year-round. You know, practices like rotational grazing, keeping livestock outside on pasture, cover cropping. These are sort of the core tenets of regenerative agriculture, and these are all things that we heavily promote with all the farming partnerships that we have throughout our supply chain. But there really hasn't been a good way of like verifying and testing what is regenerative for a long time. And so when we first started working with Whole Foods, they made us get claims, like we had to verify our claims to the USDA.
Yeah.
And so that was a good process. We learned how to navigate that. But then you realize that it's not that hard, right? You can just put some protocols together and figure it out. And it's kind of this bureaucratic storytelling activity that you can do. But what we want to do is really think about food system and change in agriculture in sort of a paradigm shifting way. And so at that point, we were looking around to kind of decide how to do regenerative sort of definition wise and how do you verify it. And what we saw Savory Institute as kind of an industry leader in that process. And a sort of a family connection to that is that my Aunt Susie went to the 1960 Rhododendron Ball with Sam Bingham. And Sam Bingham co-wrote the original Holistic Management with Alan Savory. And so Sam was preaching this to us early on.
Yeah.
And so, and we actually have Alan. I've never met. Oh, I met Alan Savory one time, but he's actually coming here for dinner Saturday night. So that'll be cool to get to hang out. But with Sam. So these are all like the figures of my childhood. That we're celebrating these concepts. And so the one thing that we really liked about their methodology is that it's an outcomes-based approach to verification. And so it really is kind of an acknowledgement that every ecosystem is unique and different. And you know, one example of this organic conversation is that we've always grown apples here at the farm. And you know, it's always been when I was a child, we sort of sold them direct, probably good, like helped me become a salesman because we were selling apples out of a produce stand on the side of the road as a little boy. And I loved it. I thought it was so much fun to meet all these people from all over the country and all these tourists that were coming in through Western North Carolina. And so, but we surely couldn't do organic apples. And so I planted an orchard here, a small orchard, just about 10 years ago with a bunch of heirloom varieties and blight resistant and have a lot more potential to grow them organically. But it's really hard to grow certified organic apples here in Western North Carolina and have the ability to make them look pretty and be acceptable to a retailer. And so I'm super humble about the notion that every ecosystem is different, everywhere is different, and the organic standards aren't super helpful in kind of building resilient food systems on a broad spectrum level and how you do this well. And so what I like about the Savory model is that it is an outcomes-based approach. We work with, like, you know, the Blue Ridge bioregion. We work with the Piedmont of North Carolina. We have the coastal plain of North Carolina. We work with folks up in Kentucky. That's a whole different region. So that just in our little region, there's a ton of small different ecosystems that are all unique. And so what we need to do is really understand what does regenerative mean and what are the outcomes for each one of these regions look like. And if we compare them year to year, we can look for improvement over time. And so that methodology really appealed to us. So we went ahead and became a Savory hub here at our home farm. And Savory as an organization is kind of promoting these global hubs as kind of experts in holistic management and the sort of regenerative, you know, methods, broadly speaking. And it's not just EOV, the ecological outcome verification process. That's one component of the holistic management framework. And so really thinking about our decision making as a holistic decision making around all these stakeholders is really kind of a Savory belief too. So to us, that was really consistent with how we were thinking already. And so it just became a good fit.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think about this from the consumer perspective for somebody who may not understand all of the agricultural terminology that we're discussing here. So could you expand a little bit about, you know, the difference between an organic certification that's input based versus the OV certification? Like, what outcomes are they measuring? At what level of frequency? Is it soil organic matter? Is it water infiltration rates? Like, what what do those two programs look like?
Great question. So, yeah, I mean, in short, the organic standards are sort of rules to how you grow organic. And we are certified organic here, by the way, at our farm, too. But, you know, it's very much like an audit every year. They come through, they look at your inputs, they look at your practices, and you kind of check the box. Are you organic or not organic?
Yep.
The EOV process is more around testing organic matter, testing your water quality, looking at your ecosystem health overall, looking at biodiversity, and then you kind of have you create a baseline in year one, and then you monitor that baseline over time, and you're looking for improvement in all those scores. And so that really is kind of that outcomes-based management creates better outcomes scenario versus a rule-following scenario that organics is. Both are valuable, and we don't, you know, really what we want to think about as a company, as Hickory Nut Gap, is as a brand, we want to be something, a brand of sort of people who care about agriculture, who care about food, and want to be trusted to make the right choices for the consumer. Because at the end of the day, all that stuff is sort of it's a lot of noise. And so really, you got about 2 seconds to make a choice at any, you know, at the retail store or whatever. And so what we're trying to do, and when we hire people, that's totally what we look for, is does this person understand all the nuance and the confusion, and they're willing to get into the details, because we want to ultimately be a company that people trust. And that's not something you can take lightly. Yep. And so, and it's complicated, and there's all these different little things, and we're learning all the time too, because this is a really hard business is, you know, its own thing, right? Learning how to run a business, and then learning how to run a food system or a meat company is its own challenge. So in that way, I think that, you know, what we, from a consumer facing standpoint, our real goal is to build trust and then layer all these activities in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so just tell the audience, Jamie, what all do you sell? Where can it be bought at? Just so people who want to support can find your stuff.
So we sell 100% grass-fed beef raised here in the on the East Coast and mostly the Southeast. We've got farmers in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, East Tennessee, Kentucky, a little bit in Ohio. And then we sell, you know, all cuts of beef. So we're a whole animal program. We're bringing in a bunch of carcasses every week and our cattle every week, turn those into carcasses. And, you know, the meat business is basically a demanufacturing business. You take one item and you turn it into about 50 SKUs. Mm-hmm. And then you try to stay balanced and utilized on all of them. And then you got like really tight gross margins. So if anything goes in the freezer, there's your cash. And so, you know, so we basically sell all cuts of beef. We sell food service cuts. We sell subprimals to restaurants. We're in U.S. Foods. We're in Sysco. We're in Performance Food Group for food service customers throughout the regions. We're selling Whole Foods is our biggest customer here in the South region. They're a great customer and have really helped pioneer a lot of these local beef programs and pork programs.
Great.
Earth Fair is a great customer. Ingles right up here in the road is one of our top customers. Mm-hmm. We sell about $50,000 a week into local restaurants as well. We've got a bunch of great local chefs and accounts. Our little farm store here in Fairview, this is our office too. And this little farm store's got a butcher shop and everything else. And it does about $25,000 a week out of here. We have a CSA. And then we've got Fresh Direct up in New York. Carries a lot of our pork and all the heritage pork they have comes from Hickory Nut Gap. We have some branded product, some breakfast sausage up in New York. So basically, you can get product from New York down to Florida. and then we have, from those are the retailers that we work with. We are talking to Harris Teeter, and it looks like we're going to go in there sometime in this summer.
Nice. What's been the hardest part of scaling from direct market to that? I mean, is it
processing? Is it aggregating all the farmers? Is it, you know, managing supply chains? Is it margin? You know, what's been the biggest challenge to really growing from zero to where you're at now?
All that stuff. I mean, it's basically, it's basically, you know, the meat business is a game of utilization, and you're also dealing with an industry that's very consolidated, with the four bigs doing like 80% of the business, in this industry. So very concentrated industry, very tight gross margins. And then making sure you're balanced. I think, you know, those have all been different major challenges at various times over the years. And so it's hard to know which one is the biggest challenge. Probably utilization and, well, here's, you know, utilization in general is always a huge operational issue, right? When you forecast your harvest, you got to make sure that you got a home for all the different pieces and parts of that animal. And then, like I say, our latest challenge is probably managing for gross margin just with inflation. That's something we're really having to watch right now. Meat processing is also a big deal. On the East Coast, there's not a lot of scaled meat processors. So our partnership at Marksberry Farm is a great partnership. They do all of our harvesting. But, you know, they're learning too. And they're a smaller plant that's growing to become more of a mid-sized plant. And there's a lot of learning curves and a lot of investment dollars there that are all difficult to manage too. So, you know, I think what I do think is cool about this industry is that, you know, our team, most of the partners that we see that want to be successful in this do kind of get that bigger picture and are interested in doing this really in a sort of holistic food systems approach. But the business model's tough, there's no doubt.
Yeah, I'm curious from like a marketing and a branding perspective. It sounds like you've got an omni-channel presence within like everywhere you could sell meat, you are selling meat. How do you maintain the storytelling aspect of like, this is what makes Hickory Nut Gap different at, you know, your Sysco reps or your US Foods reps or all the different restaurants? Like, are there highlights on the menus? Is that something that's important to you? How does that?
Yeah, we've always had a very low marketing budget because when your gross margins are small, your marketing budget's small as well. I think we're lucky because we're so close to Asheville. And so a lot of folks from like Charlotte and Raleigh, Durham, Greenville, Atlanta do come here as tourists. And so they get to see our product on menu here locally. And then they can sort of get interested in that product and want to use it elsewhere. I think the reason that we are affiliated with Western North Carolina and this beautiful part of the country is helpful because there's a romantic element to being in the mountains and having that concept is exciting for people. And then, you know, we do a lot of farm tours with chefs and various people. And I mean, every time we do a farm tour, I feel like you get people out, you see the animals, you see some pigs, you see some chickens, and you sort of tell this story in a way that people can connect to. Then that's a customer for life, right? Whether that's at Earth Fair, whether that's at Ingles, whether that's at Whole Foods, they want to buy Hickory Nut Gap. And so to me, that's an exciting thing. But it is a hard product to brand on shelf. And like, you know, there's the glass and not many people really know the companies behind the glass very well in like a fresh meat department. And then, you know, there's a lot of private label out there and a lot of the hot dog brands. They're just hot dog brands, right? They just buy ingredients, process it, and sell it. They're not in the whole carcass business. Yeah. And so as a company, we've developed a hot dog, but it's hard to get shelf space. With a one item hot dog, you need like a four SKUs to kind of get folks' attention. So I think it's, you know, we've been doing a long time too. So when you do it a long time, people kind of get the experience and want to buy. And we don't do much direct to consumer other than the farm store out here. And so that is an interesting part of our company in that we are having to, we're pretty much all, you know, B2B, very little B2C.
Oh, so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, clearly you guys have evolved and you've conquered so many of those challenges over the years. I mean, how have you funded all this? Have you taken outside capital? Have you bootstrapped the whole thing? You know, what's
so
the fundraising
we bootstrapped this thing until about 20. So about 2014 is when cattle prices skyrocketed, and we realized we were going to have to pay more for the livestock. And we realized that our systems weren't very good for like understanding how much we need to raise prices, how to do that well, all those things. And, you know, we really just kind of came at this from a from an idealistic standpoint. And the business side, we really had to learn. And so at that point, we were doing maybe $3 or $4 million in revenue. We were starting to matter to people's livelihoods, from farmers that we worked with to the staff that we employed. And I was like, this is starting to feel scary if we can't operate this thing long term. And I realized the complexity of the industry. And so actually looked to Organic Valley as kind of a great company to pay attention to and their co-op model. And so got to know some of those folks, and they invited us to their Organic annual meeting up in Wisconsin in 2016. And I actually kind of had the intention of like, maybe we turn this into a co-op. What does that look like? And we met the founder of the lawyer who drafted all the bylaws for the original Organic Valley stuff. And I had lunch with him, and then he flew down here afterwards, and we hung out for a couple days trying to kind of explore that idea. But, you know, the expense of creating a formal co-op and the sort of the coordination with all the stakeholders involved felt like a huge project that we just didn't have capacity to even think about doing. And so the advice I got at that time or soon after was pretty good from Tim Joseph at Maple Hill. And Tim's like, Jamie, you're a great benevolent dictator. Run this thing and do it right. And then when you get to be bigger, you can always pivot to once you get bigger and profitable and you're a strong company, you can do an ESOP. You can do, there's these purpose perpetual trust. There's all kinds of creative business structures that allow for stakeholder engagement. But for now, you just got to like build a company, and you need creative entrepreneurial license to do what you think you need to do to make it work. And so we did, we did raise money from just friends and family here locally. We raised a little over $1 million in 2018. And that kind of gave us a kickstart and like, oh, there's value here. How does this all look? What do we do here? And, you know, we proceeded to get out of whack on utilization. We proceeded to make a bunch of big errors and learn the hard way and you know, try to grow and lead actual leadership team and organization, all these things that I'd never done before. I learned and read all the books and you know, I've definitely learned things the hard way doing all this stuff. But I think that's the best way, right? Because then you understand that you've actually got to learn it, and it really sticks. And so at that point, we were doing about $5 million, I think, in 2017, which is what we raised the $1 million on. And you know, today we finished 2021 a little over $11 million in revenue, and we have a trailing run rate now about $14 million. So we're getting to be a pretty good company, and we're super proud of the farmers that we work with. We're super proud of the team we've put together to kind of operate this thing, and you know, super proud of the product. I think it's getting better all the time, and to me, it's exciting to sort of really understand what that looks like. But at the same time, you know, we made a little money in 2021. We'll make some money this year too, but it's still the meat business. And so, you know, we don't really feel like we're a great fit for like, you know, venture capital or any of those folks because of our sort of more stable, long-term approach to kind of systems change in an industry like this consolidated as the meat business. We're not a CPG brand. We're not a high-tech brand. We're just good old-fashioned like doers.
Which is good.
I think the potential return here, but it's the time horizon, right? That's different than most of the classical like CPG investments.
Absolutely true. We were confident that we could get to these to be a bigger meat company that is going to throw off strong net income EBITDA numbers that are going to be interesting to investors.
So yeah, what does the future look like? You know, you mentioned you're on a run rate for $14 million this year. You know, are there financial goals you're trying to hit for the next year or two, 5 years? Are there products or innovations you want to get into? You know, what are your goals for the future of Hickory Duck App?
So, you know, we've spent the last 6 months sort of trying to do some equity rate funding. And basically in May kind of realized that with the economy getting shaky, that was going to be difficult to continue to be successful at. And so at that time, we kind of pivoted to just let's stay profitable. Let's kind of weather this this economic downturn or whatever it's going to be for the next year or two or whatever it is. We're actually currently raising some money on a convertible note just to get some cash on the balance sheet and make sure we're decently strong enough to make sure we do weather it. We do have some incoming business, which is exciting. And, you know, our terms with customers and our terms with farmers and our supply chain are a little out of whack. So we do burn some cash as we add on customers. And so that's something that we pay attention to. But and so we don't want to lose the ability to not grow because of our cash position. But at the same time, what's nice about having a little cash in the bank, too, is product development. And as we, you know, right now we're kicking off a new product, like a primal blend ground beef with some organ meats in it and stuff like that, for a customer. Nice. And it always takes some R&D and it takes some, you know, thought around, you know, all the sort of process of R&D does take some money. So these are the items that we are excited to grow. Mm-hmm. And, the more branded product that we can put out into the marketplace, the better. And really looking at, you know, our gross margin targets of 15% are a super low margin target. And so one of our goals as a company is to really add on items that drive additional gross margin over time and really see the value-added division of the company as that tool, that more CPG-oriented tool. And so we're...
You better start calling yourself a CPG brand, man.
Our gross margins aren't sexy enough. No, but it's true. Like, what we're going to do is basically have... organize our financials and everything so that we have our sort of raw material partnerships and then we have our CPG partnerships, and we'll brand as much product as we can, but keep that raw material flowing from a utilization standpoint, so we can keep harvesting animals, making sure we're utilized, making a little margin, but then over here continue to try to you know, get some additional value out of the other side. And then looking at, you know, there's tons of places that this is an interesting industry with carbon credits and all that type of thing. This is all kind of in motion. There's a ton of activity and a ton of really early stage stuff happening, but we pay attention to all that. And can that be a helpful tool for the farmers that we work with? And how can we be helpful in that whole industry? There's this whole climate smart grant, the USDA grants that are coming out. Because we're a USDA hub at the farm, we can actually take on a lot of the monitoring services and all that type of activity that's going to be out there. Infrastructure-wise, you know, there's some processing activity. There's all kinds of little needs in the processing space that could be interesting. So as we look at the future, we see, you know, some partnerships with other smaller brands like Hickory Nut Gap. Do we partner up and create kind of this $100-200 million meat company, and that thing is going to really be humming at some point? So I think 5 or 10 years down the road, there's going to be much more consolidation in this industry with good partnerships, and really see us being a big part of that.
Yeah, I'm just going to spitball off that last idea because I'm a CPG. That's all I do, CPG. And I think it could be really cool if there were like local food hubs like you're talking about in the beef industry that somehow had like an umbrella banner, call it Hickory Nut Gap could be the umbrella, but there could be local beef hubs across the country, and that the beef just stays in that area, reduce the carbon footprint of transport, and it can have like a nationally recognized name, to retain that level of localized economy, that circular economy, right? So totally. I think that'd be really cool. I love where your head's at in the space. I think there's a positive outlook for what you're doing. It's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. So our final question for you, Jamie, this is a question we're going to ask everybody, and it's, what needs to happen for regenerative brands to have 50% market share by 2050?
like how much is this elevator speech, or is this
you can answer whatever way you like. You can go investment, you can go policy, you can go futuristic crazy tech thing. I don't know, you can go wherever you want.
So it's all of the above, all hands on deck, mm-hmm. for sure. I would say more than anything, it's collaboration on all those pieces. Which isn't a very exciting answer, but I think it's true. And so, policy wise, this is going to be helpful. It'll be interesting to see how this climate smart grant cycle turns out, and we can see what happens there.
Yeah.
I think collaborations between brands in this space and meat processing in particular is going to be interesting to see how this all mm-hmm. plays out. But also super helpful as we think about the growth and scale of the overall industry. I think yep. that from a financial standpoint, you know, this sort of interest in a long-term horizon, companies that are going to actually build true value through their mm-hmm. whole system is going to be part mm-hmm. of the equation, no doubt. So all those pieces yep. kind of need a little bit of tweaking, but it's totally doable. And so, I guess that's ambitious, right? So 50% market share.
I love that you said that though.
As like the four bigs, maybe 50 billion each. So the industry is what, 260, something like that in the US. So that's 130 mm-hmm. billion. Mm-hmm. It's going to hit a tipping point within that time period where things really accelerate for sure.
Yep. No doubt.
Cool. Love it, man. Thank you so much for joining us. We've talked a lot, but I learned some things today that I didn't even know before, so that's awesome. But can't thank you enough for joining us. I'm just pumped to have you on board,
yeah,
man.
Thank you all for the opportunity, for sure. It's cool to have cool. people interested.
Thanks, Jamie.
All right, see y'all.
For show notes and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.